from Mars.
Listen to the Liberty's number one podcast, Yup the Liberty's Yup the Flats. We have got another Yup the Flats episode for you today with an absolute legend from the Ross Road. Tony May, what's the crack?
All right.
Deadly to have you on. Deadly to get you on board.
Just to for the record, I'm not from the Ross Road. I'm from Fighting My Mansions. I live here the last 21 years. But originally, my family are from here. They're from Kevin Street and Golden Lane, so stone's throw. And I think we are lived in York Street before we moved up to it. So I'm back. I was born in the Kiln, the old Kiln, and I was christened in St. Francis Street. And so I'm a Liberty boy anyway, but I'm from Fighting Man. I'm from the Flats.
Up the Flats.
I'm a Fatamanian. That's what I am.
Guys, I've asked Tony to come on because he lives near enough to me, bro. My bro talks about him all the time. He speaks really highly of him. He has a story, like most of us have a story, and Tony's been generous enough to share it with us. And for something tells me this is going to be a bit of a crack and it's going to be an adventure. So look, Tony, tell us about life growing up in the flats. Go back to your childhood, give us an insight.
When I meet friends or I meet family members, always have this sort of rose-tinted picture of growing up in the flats, and I think that nostalgia comes into play, but I think what they sometimes forget how difficult it was growing up in the flats. I was in a family of 11 children, father and mother, in a three-bedroom in Fighting My Mansions, and we were pure. Back in the 50s. So I think it was 54 maybe they moved in, 55. And it was maybe 53, but I'm not sure the actual date. I was born in 59, late 59. And so I was born into a community who would have been considered as mansions, coming from the tenements to Fighting. I would have been considered. You had your own bathroom, you had a bath, the toilet, your three bedrooms and a cooking facility and stuff like that. But as time went on, there was 11 children, and there was always a great sense of community. There was always community spirit. There was always a family, and particularly my own mother and my family would give you half of what they had, which was fairly little, and they would share that amongst neighbours, especially people who were less fortunate than us. Even though we were impoverished, there was a great sense of community, but it wasn't always. I didn't always operate too well. We're in the outside, not even in the gaff or outside. And I think alcoholism played a huge part in our home as well. So you're coming from that background. You're coming from overcrowded poverty. You didn't know where your next meal was coming from. You didn't know whether the lights were going to be turned off. That type of stuff was a minefield. So, and then you had to go out into the flats and navigate that. Then one thing, navigating around at home, going into the flats is a different ballgame.
What would you say? They can be non-forgiving environments at times.
Nice school, don't think forgiving and no. Yeah.
So tell us about some of the adventures you got into them. Yeah, paint a bit of picture for me there.
Well, like for example, I didn't know I was a very sensitive child. You know, I didn't know that until I had to ignore them signs or signals, because it was a useless thing to have going into amongst the community, to be sensitive and show some sort of vulnerability. It wasn't good. You'd be crucified for that, you know?
Crucified. So I can resonate with that. Yeah. I was the same as a sense of soul, boy, held on to fears, worries, anxieties.
Had to hide it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't nurtured at home. It was told you got into trouble, you get out and you put your fists up and deal with it like that. So nobody ever sort of nurtured that. So you didn't know, you know, had our own stuff come on. I was never really encouraged to be myself. I had to be the way I was told you'd be. Well, fight your battles.
You know,
Dad's motto was hit first, ask questions later. I don't know whether that was a good idea or not, you know. Although it came to me a couple of weeks going down. And I was going, oh, no, don't do it. It was brutal. Plus, I had a squint in my eye when I was a kid, and I had to wear these glasses. And I wasn't cool to have glasses. You were single now. I was small, but I was ferocious when I got into the fight. It's the build up was unnerving, and it was the whole process of getting into the fight. It was that fight or flight always on me. I didn't know what it was. It was fear and panic. It was fear more than anything. And then once I was in there, it was good to go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, but I didn't know I was that. I didn't know it was that. I didn't know that. But what I was very good at was being, I could see flaws in people's arguments. So it was very, you know, it was...
analytical mind.
Yeah, I had, and it got me into all sorts of trouble. So I was very objective. I could see an objective view, and I would have that. And he said, oh, here we go again.
He's a bullshit filter.
You know what I mean? I was taking, I don't agree with that. And sometimes... I would say black was white. I don't know why I did it, but I did, and it got me into all sorts of problems, but it got me out of loads as well. You know? So as I said, but there was a real sense of community, and I think that the real useful thing growing in my home was wit. We were sharp with wit.
That used to get me out of a lot of trouble. Oh. I had a quick tongue.
Oh yeah.
I was little. I could slag people, I could take the piss, and I could see what you could see. You were very objective. You needed that, yeah.
Yeah, and it was like that in our home. We my brothers were elite, and they were brilliant. And it always reminds me when I seen Christy Brown, my left foot, when you're eating the porridge around the table, and he's saying, what did you say? And you were all in knots laughing, even though you're going to get a clapper, but they just couldn't help themselves just to be witty or crack a joke. And my brothers were all like that, and all fighters and footballers and all of that stuff, and drinkers, and so I look back with it with mixed feelings about my experiences growing up in the flats, because of I was single out, I was bullied because of my objectivity. I was bullied because I was vocal. I was bullied because of glasses. I was slagged off because I had a squint in my eye. I was slagged off for every chance. I was small. I didn't get a game of football unless I came down. I was probably 5 inches taller. I'd have been second pick, the foot, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I was down the pecking order in them as well. So, and the fact that I was people call it small man syndrome. I didn't even know I was small, to be honest. I just was very sensitive and couldn't see the logic why I was not getting picked, and those people who weren't as good as me. They were a bit taller, but they weren't as good as me. And you know, all them things was going on. And didn't like school. We were hit going to school because we didn't have the proper books, or you get lunch. And then we were hit for going in late. It wasn't our fault for going in late. And then my mother couldn't get us up all at the same time, or feed us and send us out.
11 kids in the gaff.
You know? And then if you didn't have a catechism, there was this horrific priest. He was a nasty man. And he used to hit kids for not knowing things about the catechism, even though they didn't have them. And he would slap them, fiercely slap them. And I resented that man, and I hated going to school. It was safer not to be at school for me.
To go on the hop a lot,
all the time. It was safer sometimes. I end up sleeping on the streets when it was about 11 or 12 because it was safer for me to stay at home, not to go home because my father, who'd become ill in the process, he was 44, he had a massive stroke, and he was unable to I suppose what you would call chastise his dad because he was paralyzed, but he was brutally tortured and he had his stick with him, you know. So I felt like I was safer not to go home sometimes, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So sleeping rough for 11 and getting pulled in and by the police at all hours of the morning, brought home to your family to say, look, we found them wandering the streets. So my daughter's 14 and she's afraid to walk off across the road on her own, like, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. So it's a different life, isn't it?
I had street skills from when I was a kid, you know?
Yeah.
So, and they served me well in a lot of ways, like, you know? So, yeah. It was a colourful experience growing up, I have to say, you know?
For any of our young viewers, a catechism is a religious book, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. It's a short version of the Bible. The Bible. Some extracts from the Bible would be in it and stories. So, yeah, I wasn't that interested in religion. I knew the Our Father and the Hail Mary, that was it.
Yeah, so just to paint the picture, look, you have to tell me, like, the difficulties at home, the personal challenges, the authority challenges. And then when people think, why did you have difficulties? All those fucking 10 or 20 things I was telling you about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a hard life, yeah. isn't it? Like, life is not easy growing up.
No.
What's it like to hear that back, saying that to yourself again?
I've had these conversations before, but I've always been very philosophical about it. And I was always very clear about how I felt about growing up. People, as I said from the outset, it was always rose-tinted glasses. It was always like nostalgic. Do you remember when the summer as well? You know, like the Gladys Knight song type of thing?
Yeah.
It was all so simple then, and some of it was. So growing up in that, coming up from like an alcoholic sort of environment and all the brothers, you know, the passage was to get to the, you know, with your dad and have a pint in the pub when you were 18, but drinking well before that. I was drinking like probably when I was about 11 years of age and stuff like that. And, so yeah, it was although there was a real sense of identity, and Fighting Man was a badge of honour to say I'm from Fighting Man, I'm from the flats, whether it was Dolphin House, Trees' Gardens, Pimlico, wherever. But not, you know what I mean? We always were very proud, and what was really good about it was we had a pool of players that was incredible footballers.
That's one thing come out of flats, good footballers. Yeah. If you think of the Bond, Fighting Man, Dolphins, Brown. Yeah. Sheriff,
yeah,
some great ballers.
Yeah, unbelievable. I have a friend, Martin O'Shaughnessy, who would say the reason he didn't give the ball to anybody was because he didn't know when he was going to get it back. So, so, and it wasn't his ball, I was the player. And he became really, really good. Again, it came to there were people much more skillful than me, but lacked in skill. I was full of endeavour and industrial. You watch him, if you're going to do, you have to go wherever he goes. You can get for you. And if you're given a job like that, he didn't want to let anyone down. So my brothers were really skillful. I'd probably be in the middle of this. I was the middle child as well. And so I was in the middle brothers as well. There was 6, 7 brothers. I was in the middle. And it was 3 older than me and 3 younger than me. And I was in the middle with the kid, with the all the family. So I was in the middle about who was, you know, to say there was 4 of them, 3 of them were better than me. And so it was 4, and then there was 3 wasn't as good as me. That was less than me. So I was always in that. But it was a... I mean, we used to go to places like Kildare and a toy in Kildare. We'd go to some parts of the country and we would be taking stuff that was left unattended, you say.
Oh,
always on the stroke.
You know what I mean? I remember one time we just raided this factory down there. It was like, cars, you know, they got out something, had them all on the bus. But the police came and they knew Fatima was in town. So we got them back anyway. There was no one arrested, but we had went in and took them all and we got them back out. But we were renowned for our football. And there was an element of it that was criminality involved, because even my eyes growing up, I knew that in fashion particularly, and I didn't have the money to get it. And I wasn't stupid, and I thought, well, why is other people that are seeing town there able to have these clothes? And I was trying to add it up. Well, how are you doing that? And then they were working, basically. They came from maybe much more affluent families, and you're able to do that, and you're able to provide them with these clothes. And whereas I just thought, I want to be like that. I want to have them clothes. So I went about getting it illegally. And I would go on and I would take stuff and I got caught early, and getting charged with larceny and all of them types of things. And so as a result of that, the early days was in Patrick's institution and things like that. So going in there as a young kid who had no real sense of myself, nobody guided me.
And you're already bringing the baggage that we spoke about earlier, bringing that with you. Yeah. Not only did the flats are harsh and warm, you're going now into it.
I'm going into it. A big offset of flats. You're talking Sheriff Street, Trees' Garden, you're talking Summer Hill, you're talking like Gardner Street, you're talking the whole shebang. It's run in the middle of all that. And luckily enough, you'd know people. And it was a rite of passage as well. I call it the unnatural progression. And it was unnatural for any child to grow up and expect to go into these places. And that was just a reality. That was because I didn't have the sense of self and why I was doing these things. It was almost like you were all doing it.
A lot of conscious level then. Yeah. You're just fucking crap.
It was a subconscious thing. Yeah. You know, I didn't even know that. And it was only later on in life that I could see that, even at a subconscious level, how traumatized I was by certain events in my life. So it was only through embarking on a new journey later on in life that I began to see why I was doing these things, but it was left to me on the voices. As I said, I didn't have anybody who nurtured me or who could identify some talent in me and say, listen, someone put their arm around my shoulder and say, listen, this is a patch you're gonna take. If you continue on doing this, this is where you're gonna end up. Is a route this way that you can avoid that. Nobody was told, you go to walk. No one told me about the principles of walk. I was looking at it going, I'm walking for 5 a week and I could probably get that in an hour. Now the chances are I'd probably take a few hours to get that. 5 a week when I was a kid was, them times was a lot of money, but I just thought.
So as you said, you started self-medicating unbeknownst to yourself from 11, 12.
Oh, yeah.
When did it start getting heavy? Gargling, drugs?
Initially it was just alcohol, and then the progression of hash. Get the hash and the alcohol, and you just didn't think you could go out without that. And then, the introduction of opiates and amphetamine and cocaine and heroin kicked in I took heroin for the first time in 1978, and I was in the Thomas More House, and these people who eventually got involved in distributing it around the city offered me a bit, and I was intrigued by it. I just said, I'd have some of that, but it wasn't that much that I was really stoned or anything. But it done something for me, and I thought, that wasn't bad. It wasn't enough to get me really, and then it just took over. It was just landed here. It just landed here. It was a real...
The 80s was heavy, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was like, it was heavy. 79, 80 was when it arrived. And then when I got it in the form that I used it in, it was like tail on the head for me. It didn't... It erased any insecurities I had, it erased any any doubts I had about myself. It just neutralized all that. It just made me feel this warm feeling. Didn't care. I had everything out of it, like, you know. But that was the soon torn on me anyway. And I didn't know that. I didn't know the nature of it. I didn't know the nature of the beast, what I was engaged in. And what it done was a pain relief more than anything. It was a coping mechanism. And I didn't understand it. And there was the whole communities were just torn apart by that. You know? I'd been back into Patrick's in and out from when I was 16 upwards until I was 20. And then the progression down into Mountjoy. And then in and out of Mountjoy for years, being strung out from getting bouts of, you know, I wouldn't say sobriety or anything, but absent from held or heroin particularly, because that was the drug that was getting me into all sorts of trouble. But it was getting into trouble anyway through alcohol and trying to having to have the money for that, you know. And so there was all of that going on, you know.
Yeah, there was no family immune to it. Like, it was right through the liberties. No. Now the inner city, you know, I can remember clearly. I don't remember a lot of the drugs, through all the drugs. For all the, you know, the concerned parents, the marches, the fucking, the robbing. I was only telling me young one there, the 80s, end of the 90s, the amount of people that don't jump over armed robberies. Like I used to drink in the pub around here, the Chinaman's and that was handy. The amount of people that used to come in after jump over, and she was like, what's a jump over that? Someone ran with a bank card, you know? And heroin, it was synonymous.
What happened was you had these people who you could trust. Basically, people trusted them. You knew they were, we would call them ordinary decent criminals.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, they were doing things that was way out of character. They were different beings altogether. The physical sense had changed. The whole attitude had changed. The whole trust had gone down. They started turning on people in the flats and robbing like flats in their own communities, which that was unheard of. You could leave your doors open, but because of the compulsive nature of the drug, if you didn't have it, you'd be withdrawn. So you had to get it, and it didn't matter who got in the way. And then your mates was ripping you off, which you never experienced. Probably bogart a joint on you or something, but they wouldn't rip you. Do you know what I mean? So this was happening, and people were looking at, these were like, it was like these were zombies. They had turned into lovely people and had turned into like the Thriller Blade video. Do you know what I mean? They were trolling. It was horrific. And then HIV hit. And then it was a whole different ballgame. And then my own brother died from AIDS. And I don't know how. God only knows how it never contracted. HIV. I mean, used with him all the time. I used people with full-blown AIDS. It didn't matter to me, because the power of wanting to use and the compulsion to use was so strong. It didn't matter what you didn't care about tomorrow. You just wanted it now. And now was like, it didn't matter who you were using after. It was a game of Russian roulette. And I think I have a gene that was able to fight that off. I had Hep C, but it naturally rid itself in the body, got rid of it.
My cousin was saying just after the 80s, he got AIDS full blown now, F, A, B, and C, lung collapse.
You know, and I was
14, he started.
Do you know what I mean? So, like, you have all these things that was happening, and people just were powerless to do anything about it. They were unskilled with dealing with this stuff. It just landed on them. Poverty in itself was hard enough. It was a tough life anyway. And all of a sudden, here we go. This wave of this epidemic that had just descended on them. And they didn't know how to do it. So when the vigilantes was born from concerned parents who are really concerned. You are parents who are really concerned. And then it turned out that people, you know, who were involved were just some of them are very violent and just attached themselves with that and just had a reason to exercise the brutality and the violence and power over people. And then, but they didn't see them as sick people, they just seen them as scum of the earth, and they didn't treat them very well. And then when I've been subject to that, I was barred from the flats for selling hash and stuff like that, you know what I mean? And they, you know, they barred me from the flats. They had a fuck.
Yeah, I got kicked off my own road on John Dillon Street with the concerned parents. I wasn't able to fucking play on my own road.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's like, what the hell, like, you know? So, and then, like, there was always, like, and then I remember feeling really, I remember getting sent to prison one time for something I hadn't done, right? But as soon as, you know, you'd fight it off, you'd try to find it, you'd try to fight it and say, you know, what I'm doing, and you'd get there and you could go, look, it's poetic justice really because of all the stuff we got away. But it was once I got my head around that, I said, look, you know what I mean? Should have been here for loads of other things. Be all right with it, you know? And so that happened. And then another one that I ended up having, I went to the High Court with a charge. I was singled out, picked out for a robbery, smashing a car window and taking a handbag. Was people in it.
Another huge handbag robbery car.
And I knew who did it. I didn't think they would find me guilty because there was very little evidence other than visual contact, eye contact, which it doesn't really hold in court. Visual identification is not enough. But yet they found me guilty. And again, I got in and I was really disappointed about that one. Do you know what I mean? I thought, yeah, I'd get the court. There was someone that was with who said she'd come to court with me, but she was sick and I had the money to get her some girl how she'd come to court with me, and she wouldn't answer the door, and I had to go to court anyway. So I was found guilty anyway. So, and I think around that time I started really getting in touch with myself, with me as a person, as a human being, and this freaked me out because the first time I ever saw, like, the moon, right? Like, you've seen the moon hundreds of times, but I've seen it one night, I smoked some fucking black hash in the cell, and someone was calling and I looked out and there was a full moon and I just it was floating around, none harm or up. I just realised that I've never been taught that. And, you know, we were in a solar system, all that stuff didn't fucking dawn on me, thought, and it freaked me out, right? It freaked me out. What the fuck? What is all this? And it's weird how vulnerable you become and how I was looking for something. I didn't know what I was looking for. I was looking for some sort of to make sense of my existence, right? And why was I on this planet? And why was I not that type of thinking, right?
Existential.
Yeah, right. So it was, you know, and I remember being beforehand, what happened was I was walking around the exercise yard up the joy and there, and Anthony May, a visit. He was a John May. Assumed it was my brother Johnny, who later on died, and it was my cousin John May, and he was the leader of the Jehovah's Witnesses in Dublin and Ireland actually, and he's very convincing, and I didn't need much convincing because I was very vulnerable. I was feeling cited because I was found guilty for something I hadn't done, and I thought it was unjust, which I was, but you know, as I said, poetic justice fails anyway. So and I'm there sitting, he's telling me about God had plans for me, right? So he had no plans for myself. He said whoever God was to me, I didn't even understand that. I used to go Hail Mary or Our Father, that'd be it, and you say your prayers and, you know, and then say your sin, Father, it's a week since my last confession type of thing, it's all lip service. But he convinced me that God had a plan for me, and it was going to be pain-free, and it was going to be forever, and it was going to be all these bells and whistles and no pain anymore, and I would never die and all this stuff, right? I was convinced. I remember going into the government the next morning, and I said to him, I want to resign the Catholic Church. He was looking at me, But I had to write to the Minister of Justice for permission to do that, right? Because I was in his care. And so I wrote out this half sheet. You have to write out this half sheet.
Yeah.
And, you know, to human rights concern to the Minister of Justice, whoever it was. And the governor had to co-sign it. So I could get spiritual guidance off the Jehovah's Witnesses, right? And for a visit. I wasn't even getting any drugs in the visit. But it was weird because I was very open to some sort of meaningful, you know, reason why I was here. Looking to, you know, what's the story here? it makes sense of my existence. You know what I mean? I knew I belonged to a family. I knew I was I was from Fatima, but when push came to shove, it was very it was fucked up.
Because you've no attachment. I mean, you're attached to flats, but as a human connection, I'm not saying about your mom or your dad. I'm sure they weren't available.
Yeah.
You know, there was no attachment. That's what drugs get you.
Yeah.
And that's what God does. Exactly. Attachment.
It does, and that's you have some sort of identity, right? It was an identity. It was a heroin addict. It was a criminal. It was from the flats.
Attachment. Exactly.
So when that experience with the smart bit of law and seeing the meal for the first time, it freaked me out, right? It took me a couple of days to get my head around it. Nearly lost it, like, you know what I mean? I was like, wow, how vast this was. And I didn't realise how minuscule I was in all this. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Never thought, you know what I said?
Conscious of your actual consciousness.
And existence, right? Yeah. And it freaked me out a little bit, right? So, and then I came down to earth a little bit, right? So it's still used going out on the visits, and I still like the idea that there was a power greater than me that was loving and caring and wanted to provide me with this long and everlasting life that was painless or pain free, and that it was utopia really. But it was an expect, I suppose I expected it was going to last, but it didn't. So it wore off. So I mean, I used to just go out because the good. John May stopped coming up, right? He had other, I suppose. He had other fishes to fry, really. Do you know what I mean? He had to convince people with a lot of lies that I hope he's not saying this. But he'd even tell you that himself anyway.
Is he saying the Jehovah's?
No, he resigned from them. He resigned. I was only having a conversation with him this morning about vaccines and about small. And so he stopped coming up. He sent this man up who had. His second in command maybe it was, but he was a beautiful man, and he was so spirit, you know, he was so well, he was convinced that what he was doing was the right thing for him, and he was really, really nice guy, and he had nothing but love and tolerance and patience, which I had none of. Right. Spiritual principles that are alien to me.
Of course, it's a different language.
Do you know what I mean? And I'm going, and I was attracted to that, right? Because I wasn't born into that. I was brought up told what to do. I was never told why are the principles behind that. So I didn't understand the principles as such. And that if there was a principle or you paid back money, and that was a principle. I knew that type of principle, but spiritual principles were different, you know. And I could get that off him in abundance, right? And he turned up all the time. And then eventually I think I got out. And you know, once you're in there, you still have to negotiate your existence in there, and you have to avoid certain pitfalls. I was very diplomatic, and I was able to mix with the best and the worst. You know what I mean? My son always says, you know, it's always good to be on the wrong side, the right side of the wrong people. And that's the way I was in prison. So I would have known people that, you know, that were renowned for criminals, renowned criminals that I got on really well with. And when you pair all that image down, and you were just like me, you were vulnerable, but you had this image to maintain, you had this reputation to keep, and you could see they were just ordinary Joe Soaps. They're coming from the same background for me. Dysfunction, from poverty, from lack of opportunities in the community, all of that stuff, who found a way into criminality, and they saw that they could earn money far easier than going out to work. So, without mentioning any names, but there was a whole load of people, and you knew who to avoid as well, and not to cross, or, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you became a people pleaser to some extent. But it was all about diplomatic skills and who to help.
Survival,
right? You knew what to do, where to go to, who to avoid, who to appease, who to say no to, you know? So it was a very skillful thing to do, you know, especially in prison. Fortunately enough, I never had to be involved in a riot in Mountjoy, you know. I never had to be.
Many years did you do all in all in prison?
Probably about 8 years, in different, you know, different settings.
Years here, too. Here,
yeah, I've done a few more. I've done 5 months in England. Brixton and
what was that like?
Scrubs. It's a bit more difficult than this.
Yeah, what was that like going to England? Because we know the relationship you had and you going over there.
No, there's a lot of Irish there. There's a lot of second, third generation Irish there. Anyway, most of the people that I was locked up with in England were all Irish names. So I met someone from Teresa's Gardens. I was going, my man's from Teresa's Gardens. You know that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Again, I had to apply the same principles. Careful,
the universal, aren't
you? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you have to be worried. You have to sort of assess it. You have to sort of, you know, what's the story here? And it's that orientation when you're just being orientated into it. You go in disorientated, but you have to get orientated fairly quickly, you know? But as I said, you go through this, and I was involved in, I was a petty criminal. I was a terrible criminal. I was getting caught all the time. The stuff I was doing was very, like, people would see me doing it, or it was that type of stuff. So it was liable to be arrested anyway. So so it was always through that in and out of prison, and then, as I said, I got strung out and managed to get a few years keeping it together, just drinking and smoking a bit of hash or weed, dropping some massa on mushrooms, some coke. As long as you stay away from the brown, you're brand new, right? Stay away from that.
Yeah.
You know, wanted that. Stay off the ground, you know. But I just didn't have, I would get bouts of being able to do that. But then, you know, eventually the go-to drug was the pain. It was the painkiller, really, you know. But it was all nasty on you then. And then, so as I said, it was like that. And, you know, then I think around 86, I started thinking about, we have a problem here with drugs, you know? I mean, a serious problem. I was getting bouts of staying away from it, but getting heavily involved in alcohol and other drugs. And still always some drug.
Always some kind of initiation.
It was all that going on, and I didn't. Sorry. So it was always some sort of substance, and you know, especially with the football, then you get involved in the football and you follow the team that was winning all the tournaments. Fine, man, we're known for it, right? You were the best in this area for sure, and probably in Dublin if you were to count up all the trophies up. There's great footballers from Trees Garden, from Dolphin Hills, from Oliver Bond, from York Street, and all around the surrounding areas. But you had a pool of such talented players, right? With the Reeds and the Mays, the O'Shaughnessys, the Coleman's, hope we don't leave anybody out, the Bow, wherever, like the Bows, whoever. They were just we were blessed with so many gifted and talented players, right? But they all had substance problems. The problem was they could never fucking get enough of it.
What did one of the arse about Tommy Adams say? Have a drink problem every time I go to the bar. Mercy's in UA.
Yeah, he pours up there. So there was always that. And there was always violence as well. There was always, you know, involved in some sort of violence or some sort of fights. And it was part and parcel of growing up. And you know, I remember being sentenced for, I was on crutches at the time when I done, tried to do a jump over on crutches. Imagine that.
That's
so
paradoxical.
Yeah, right. And you know what? If it was so, what I'd be able to do was that. It was that athletic, like, you know.
Yeah.
Um, I remember the police standing over me the next morning, assisting me into the car. And that somebody, the man was injured in the shop and I got sentenced for that as well. So there was always periods of really, that where alcohol was just causing real problems, right? So there was always some sort of drug that was causing me problems. So I'd end up in the bride, but I'd end up waking up and I'd wet the bed, or, you know what I mean? And then, you know, I had a mother who had seven boys who were addicted to either drugs or alcohol. And, you know, as a father now, as a grandfather now, I know that, what that's like, and I feel that. And I said, God help us, she was such a powerhouse that she was able to manage that, and looking at us, you know, the boys in front of her, dying in front of her, and what that must have been like for her. So it was only so throughout the years, I remember actually going to London because the drugs were better there. So we used to go to drug.
You travelled around the world a bit, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I go around now. We, for example, so we had these periods of not using heroin, but we do it every now and then behind the door, how no one would see us, right? Because it was always that buzz, it was always that comfort, it was a great buzz. So we do it behind the door, but we had this sort of contract that we didn't do it in front of people. We do it behind our closed doors, so we were still off it, right? But we'd have the sneak in. We were able to save some money, and we put the idea that we'd go away to Europe, somewhere to Greece. And remember, we got there, and like, it was a whole new world open to us, you know. And it was a group of us that used to go, and we'd go to Greece and we'd go around the islands. And then we went to, I remember, these Australians invited us to, you know, on a journey from Athens up through from Yugoslavia into Austria and into Germany through Switzerland and Germany and then up to Amsterdam. Like it was like
that's from Fight
Man. Look the flats, and that's all we ever do. Look the flats, right? And I have a video actually. I go skiing now, right? And I have a video of us all going down with tricolours in Trysil in Norway at a convention. Narcotics Anonymous Convention, and we're all there. The flats about Sheriff Street, Ballymun, Fatima.
And back then were you using?
Just recently, last few years.
Went away,
we were just drinking, and if there was other drugs we could get, we paid, but not heroin, not brown. But someone came with some methadone or something, we'll get super dry. Get the molly into it, drop the brand new. But so this had opened up, but then through that period, I began to use again. And then what happened was, with me particularly, I remember going out with this girl who was beautiful. She was an amazing woman. She was an amazing girl. She got involved. She found Jesus and God, only one win a day, you know, and I wasn't going to win against Jesus, and she chose him over me, and it absolutely folded like a deck chair. I couldn't comprehend how easy it was hard, and how easy, where I just used more drugs to ease the pain, and somebody had rejected me, and had left me, and it was, I didn't know how to handle that. This was the first time ever I had been so savagely affected by someone walking away from me. I couldn't, and I couldn't even understand what to be loyal to somebody, you know, because I've seen so many friends who are going out with girls, being with other girls, and I thought it was the norm, so I used to do that. I didn't, if it meant then that it was, I only knew then that it was self-esteem issues. It wasn't, I was trying to, you know, conquer this thing, and I know he's such a great bloke, I'm able to get the boards and all that stuff. I remember when she done that, and it just rocked me to the absolute core. You know, I just didn't know how to. Again, I talked to you earlier about nobody had told me, and nobody had nurtured me, nobody had said to me, you're going to be heartbroken, and that's just the way it's going to happen. You have to allow to take place, gather around your family. You can't snap it over. I'll be more than one of my torn anyway. In God's squad has a labor, that type of stuff. But shit, it was absolutely destroyed us. And I got really down. I got really strung out. I got really strung out then. I got it. And then I remember, you know, we need to get out of this town. We need to get out of here. We're going to go to Greece again. We're going to go over there and we get to Israel. Right? So anyway, we get to Greece and we had this bottle of methadone that we were going to do a 10-day detox. And it was gone in 3 days. And so we guzzled that. We were left with just alcohol to get us through that. It was a mad thing. We ended up in... get to Israel. We booked it. We get a ferry from where we go. We got from went to Crete, which we couldn't get from Crete to Israel. We had to go back from Crete to Athens, from Athens then to Israel. The first guy I met in Israel was from Adelaide. Row was a Jewish, an Irish Jew. The first man I met, an Irish Jew from Adelaide Row. His dad was the rabbi in the synagogue on Adelaide Row. And then I met a family from Mee Street. Who had moved there, a Jewish family, and the son was in the Israeli forces then. But there was all that going on. I was trying to, you know, I still had this compulsion in my head, just this to use, and I just couldn't, you know, I was just drinking raw vodka, and you were possibly going to walk every morning. I was hiding on the duty. You turn up at this pub, and you people would wait, you know, and you pick you, and you go off. I didn't want to do that. I just hadn't had headspace. Mine wasn't right, and there, getting out of the shop. I mean, a nice few quid going, like, you know. And then we said, look, the price of getting out of this Israel, where do you want to go? It was Paris or Munich? And I said, go to Munich, because we had been there the year before at the beer festival. I said, get to Munich. We got a few quid in Munich, right? We got a few quid in Munich. Let's get there. And so we decided. We were all in. We only take whatever money we had. Munich, please. We'll get a few when we get there. We'll use our street smarts when we get there. And we got there from someone from, I was with, from Mee Street, because he wasn't having a good time, and some of the people in the crew didn't like him. And I didn't want to see him left, just ostracized. And I said, I wouldn't do that to the human being. So I said, come on, we'll go. We'll get the money when we get to Munich. But he had no money. But we got sus trying to fucking touch for a few quid handbag in the train station, and it came on top, so we had to hide. You know, we'd no money, we'd and we'd have been left in another country in prison that day. So we had to hide, and then I just met people, I used my street smarts, and I met an Irish Australian, and his name was Michael McMahon. Proud Irish man, even though he's never in Ireland. He's more Irish than me, right? And he I was telling him about applying the money that we expected, and it didn't turn up. And he gave us money and bought us beer and all of that stuff. And then I met this beautiful Swedish girl, who we went up to Amsterdam with these two Canadian guys. I wasn't even aware of these two gorgeous Swedish girls, these two good looking guys, Canadian guys. They have to be with each other. Well, I can be very charming as well. So, I got involved with this Swedish girl. But I was only years later, I found out they were gay. I didn't know that. But, and they were leaving me at the train. I was leaving them at the train station to go to Amsterdam. I said, I'm fucking getting on this train. I don't care. I had them bump. And I jumped on the train and then you only got Amsterdam. I got the come around for tickets. No ticket, I was hiding in the toilet, he got me out. He said, I'm gonna have to get off the train on the German border and the Dutch border. But the Canadian guys bought me a ticket and got me to Amsterdam. He rang me down, he bought me weed, he bought me beer, and he let me stay in the hotel and all of that stuff. I still have contact every now and then. I'd get a like from that girl from Sweden, I'd get a like from it, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And she was very, I suppose, influential in ways, because I had said to her, I always saw big time, because she sorted me out a few times over there, and I said, when you come to Dublin, when you come to Dublin, I'll look after you. I'll look after you. And she came to Dublin, I don't know, wash. And I was strung out. And she done the same for me again.
Wow.
And I was so embarrassed by it, though, you know. And I remember trying to go and make an amends to her in Stockholm. And years ago, about 6-7 years ago, I went and said, I owe this woman an amends. And she said, if they're over here, come over, don't, you know, it'd be good to see you. And I just wanted to give her money. Because she had paid so much. And I wanted to give money. She says, if you try to do that, you can just go, but don't want that. We didn't do it for them. I was able to buy the meals and give her son some money, which she didn't know about. And she didn't know, and she would just, you know. And they just welcomed me in. They just cooked food for me, all of that stuff. And such, because I always never sort of came across people like that. Want to do something without looking for anything in return.
Gotcha.
I just couldn't comprehend that concept. I just couldn't. And that was a real attraction to me. Not just because she was a good looking woman, but that, you know, I valued that. And I wanted to be able to, I suppose, adopt them type of principles. And as I continue on using it, really, really bad. I got bad again, went back into prison, back to old prison, back to England. I went for a weekend, I said, to get out of a treatment centre. I said, I'd go for the weekend. I had wardens in London. I got pulled on the way back. There was a guy carrying some drugs, and he just said, come over, accompany me. And I said, I'm not going near that England. Loads of charges. And I took some heroin. I became invisible, didn't I? And I decided to go. And I got nicked and I was in custody for 4 months. My son is Tony, he's only, he's 30 now almost, and 92 it was. And I got arrested busted at the bar. I was arrested in Holyhead, brought to London to wait on trial in Brixton Prison, and you know, woman scrubs, and you meet all sorts of stuff. So the journey is varied, it's checkered, it's being like that, but what I didn't know that this was bringing me to a place of discovery, a place of opportunity. When I got so bad, I became so desperate for my drug use that I didn't know, and I only discovered that it was the gift of desperation. I was prepared to do anything to stop using and hopefully stay stopped.
When did that all turn around?
That happened in 97. I had started years before trying going in and out of treatment. I was in Kilmoyne for about 10 months. I was gone from prison to Kilmoyne, got out, strung out again, and I got really, really bad. I was seriously bad. And eventually I got into a treatment centre, and I'd been introduced to Narcotics Anonymous in 91 in St. Michael's Apple Ward in Bond. I didn't understand the mind, how it works, and I didn't understand the concept of it, but because I was so desperate and I was so open and I was so willing to adopt what he was saying, to incorporate these principles you're talking about into my life, which I never really had, and that gave me this opportunity, and I didn't know that it was going to take off and provide me with a life that was beyond me. Stopping using for one was beyond my wildest dreams, and not having a compulsion to use after that. They said you won't have to use again, that the compulsion to use would lift, right? And that never lifted in me. It always was there in me all the time. I started going, listening to people who were on the same journey, who had been through the same system with me, through poverty, alcoholism, prisons, treatment centres, intravenous drug users, HIV, AIDS, people dying in their communities, and there was hundreds and hundreds of people that I knew that had died. I have a video called Off the Wall we did on Fatima a few years ago. I must give you a look at it. And the amount of people that died, and we used to be an arch in Fatima, we used to play handball there. So we went back and we threw the ball up for everybody that was had died, and we had a competition. We got everybody all from people who lived in Clondalk and who were living in Wexford. They all converged on Fatman because it was the last team they were playing now and stuff like that. You should have a look. It's called Off the Wall. It's on your page somewhere. And again, I was doing that social analysis thing, and my motto was that I wasn't that interested in the transformation from flats to houses. It was more the transformation of people for me, because I knew that if they didn't change going into this new community, new houses, that would revert back to their old ways of doing things. Of course. Because the honeymoon period wear off, the houses is, you know, it was all new and spanking new, but behaviours was still going to be the same. So here I was in this place where I had nothing else to lose, and I had thought, you know what, this is my last chance here. I have to try to do something. Like, I was 47 years of age, and I got clean, and I remained clean since then. In 1997, we got 24th of April in 1997, we got clean, abstinent from all drugs. And then that just embarked on a whole different journey, a whole life on life's terms, to experience it without the use of drugs, having to develop skills that I never had to adopt principles and practice in my life to get me out of these cul-de-sacs that find myself in, or these corners, paint myself into a corner, back myself into a corner, and I didn't have the skill set to get out. So the basic principles that were saying, you know, I talked about earlier, this man that had him, he had this love and affection, and he had tolerance and forgiveness and all of these things that I needed to exercise in my life, all the resentment that I had from previous relationships or people who had hurt me in the past, or members of my family or my father or whatever it was, that I carried them around with me. I didn't know that I was up to my neck in trauma and resentment and bitterness, and I couldn't function properly unless I was able to find a way to let that stuff go and find a way to alleviate all the harm that I had caused people, at least make the effort. And the 12 steps gives you that opportunity, you know what I mean? It gives you a way of amending some of the stuff that you've done, most of the stuff that you've done, and accept the stuff that you can't change, like things that could never go back and amend. And I could do it indirectly with other things, like being involved in community, helping out with people, giving some time of my time to voluntary organisations, or paying some money to concern, or things like that. Mm-hmm. Ways of amending the stuff that I could never do. I couldn't go back and tell the police that I was actually doing X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. It says we make such amends, except when to do so would injure you or others. So I didn't want to be putting myself at risk of going to prison. I have children now. I had to raise these, and that again was a whole new ball game. And I wanted to make the adjustments. I wanted to break the cycle in my family. For the first time in my life, I was faced with taking responsibility and being a partner and sharing the responsibilities with the children and domestically. I was called out by this Alabama girl from Alabama. She, Annie from Alabama, she's an American in the treatment center. And she heard me making a chauvinistic comment. And she was very feminist. She was a feminist. So she challenged me on it. I didn't like her challenging me in front of people. So I cited that and I said, get hooked. You know what I mean? But what she had done was she set me up really. She used to expose me a bit in because I was very vocal. Again, I was very vocal. I wanted to learn. I wanted to, you know, try new ways. And she knew that. She knew that my enthusiasm was brimming. And then she'd say, would you not like clean a house? That's the woman's job. You know what I mean?
Oh,
I
know. But
it was to me.
That's what we grew up
with. I would say that, right? And so she used to set traps and say, right, do the Delph this week or Hilver or Brush the Club, you know what I mean? That type of stuff. Bring the kids to school and like, do that, all that stuff. And then it was crucifying trying to do it. seriously, it would be probably 2 hours before I went up to the aftercare and I hadn't done it. And I swear, it was like pulling teeth without an anesthetic to just do stuff like that. But I didn't want her to get the best from me. Now, I could have went up and lied where I wanted to do it, but what it set me on a course of discovery about what had happened then in the end, that I ended up having to look after the kids myself. So this was, it was priming me and prepping me. And I always believed that there was a force or a power greater than me that was taking care of me for some reason.
Jehovah.
And had a part, well, hey, whoever he is.
Jehovah, right? Was looking after
well, you know, Jehovah, he had bricks.
You told you, you paid your fee.
But something on about Jehovah, but yeah. There was a power greater than me, that there was a loving power, force, whatever it may be, because there was all these serendipity moments that it just didn't make sense to me. But then when I looked around, I thought, you know what? This is a course that's been set for me. This has been a plan. And look, it was very, very painful as well. Again, I didn't have the skills to deal with being in relationships, to be faithful, to be loyal, intimate. Then I was living with somebody who wasn't good mentally at some points in their life through whatever, and trying to negotiate that, trying to stay clean, trying to you know, create a career for myself, and stay clean, be involved, giving back, and trying to be, again, in them intimate relationships, how do you perform, how do you conduct yourself? So I had to learn all this stuff, and it was all trial and error, really. But what I had was, I had NA, and I had a fellowship to go to, and talk about my difficulties, and talk about all the adversity that was happening in my life. I didn't have the skill set to deal with it, but I got the support and the direction, and I knew somewhere subconsciously something happening here, right? And then I remember actually being in the relationship I was in, and obviously there was something in me saying this is not working. Now I intuitively I could feel this, right? Consciously I was saying, no, I'm still in, I have kids here. I remember going to the city council, put my name down on the list, and that relationship came to an end. And by the time I was a month living in my friend's house in Hardwick Street, he let me stay there. And I always got the support I needed through the NA Fellowship. And my mom let me stay there for a while. Then I was offered a place around the corner. So, and then the kids came to live with me, which was another dealing with trauma, here I am, a man that had, remember, so I'll tell you how about the chauvinistic thing. I remember wanting to be part of my child's life. My youngest son, Aiden, was born, and my mom had seen me go in the shops one week with a shopping bag. Where are you going? I went to the shop to get milk and bread for the kids. Why can she not get that? And I said, because she's in a course, or she's cleaning or whatever. Like that looking at me, you know, she wasn't too pleased that, you know, I wouldn't go to shops for her, why would he want to be gone to fucking anyone else, like, you know what I mean? So Aiden was born, and I got this, you know, these harnesses,
yeah.
So I had him in here, I had him in the harness, proud as punch, you know what I mean? And I had a shopping bag, and she says, I'm going around to her, that's it, she said, I'm going around to her, I won't have her. She's making an idiot out of you. Look at you, like a woman now, right?
Yeah.
And that's what I had to compete with and contend with, that these stereotypical views of men and manhood, and that they didn't do them things. She didn't see it as sharing in the responsibility. She's seeing it as me being weak and not being a man enough to say, no, I'm not wearing that. I'm not bringing them on. I wanted to do it. She says, I want to deal with this man. There's something wrong with you. You know what I mean? No, I want to do something. I want to make a difference, right? And she was so proud that I got clean. I got a job, full-time job in the community. And I remember getting a little car, and I had a computer, and I had a briefcase. It looked like a briefcase. And she knew I was doing council, basic council courses and social analysis, all of that stuff, right? And I remember I'm not leaving this computer in the car for someone. So I'm walking in the door, right, to my wife to get a cup of tea, and she's talking to her name and said, it's a counsellor. And I'm looking at him. Oh, fucking, he's a count. And I'd gone in with the ligament, you know? So she was so proud. And I remember doing a eulogy saying, by the way, I'm not a fucking counselor. I'll be coming. You'll need counseling after that. But she was so proud. Here I was, making a difference, and that I had shown and I demonstrated that there was a real change had taken place in women. I wasn't playing lip service to it. I was talking and walking what I was saying, I was doing. You know, I could play lip service to lots of stuff. And what I learned then was to you know, honor my word. If I was going to commit to something, I'd honor that. And if I couldn't, I'd have to be, literally couldn't do it. I'd turn up on time, which I never did. I could never be counted on. I could give me word and they'd know I'd take it. Here I was, turning up on time, giving me word on honor, committing to things and seeing them through. And these were stuff that was just building in me, and character that was building in me. And people began to see change. To me, I didn't see it that. Through the naked eye, you wouldn't really see the change, but these things that were taking place was building resolve in me, was building character in me, it was character building exercises. So that relationship ended up, I ended up living on my own. And then the children came to live me. Here I am, like the Tasmanian devil gone. I'm like a sergeant, hey, you get that, get this, you know? And eventually I was able to get the rest. Do the lunches the night before, press the clothes the night before, so it at least alleviate that pressure of getting them up and not being able to treat them as individuals. And it was all like sergeant major stuff, it was all that stuff, right? But I was trying to, with the limited skills, I was trying to do my best, basically. And so as I said, I was, the world was my oyster, really. I got married there. I met this girl, Veronica. It's funny, I have an incredible story. I have, my ex was pregnant on my youngest son, Aiden, the guy that I had in the harness. She was pregnant on him, probably about 4 months pregnant. And I'm in a photograph with my wife now, with her, that I was with the girl who was pregnant, but my wife now was in the photograph with her, and my wife now helped raise the baby that wasn't even born, Aiden, with me. And I was just like, you know, it's
more serendipity.
You know what I mean? And here I am. You know, and I always look back at that photograph and say, that's where I ended up with this woman, Marion Horn. She helped raise that child that was unborn and has a real strong relationship to them. Separated right now at the moment with my wife, and again, through my experiences and looking back at how I dealt with disappointment and, you know, not rejection, but, you know, if the ending of something has taken place that I'm not overwhelmed by, I didn't fall like a deck chair, I remained, you know, very focused. So I wasn't very happy about it, I didn't call it. But now that it is what it is, I'm able to say, you know, acceptance is a huge part of my life. If I can accept my reality, well, then I don't have to fight it as much. If I'm fighting something that I can't change, well, then I'm going to fight a losing battle. It's going to be arduous. It's going to be painful. I'm going to be resentful. And all I can try to find is that I can find all the good stuff about it. Just days where I say, but it's like that. And again, I got introduced to, I'm very interested in history. I like, you know, about the universe. I didn't know there was 3 trillion billion galaxies. I didn't know all of that. I know about a bit about quantum physics, and I love history. And I go down to, you know, skiing. I was in skiing. Where was I skiing? First time in Meribel in France, right? Got an opportunity to go skiing. Great idea. Great crack, right? Done that for a few years, get to Norway for a skiing convention, skiing recovery it's called, so people who are abstinent from drugs go there, have this convention and ski on, and then I'll show you the video sometime, and see skiing all down with a tricolour, the flats and all, right? We'll get a load of head cases, like people, like fucking nut jobs in their past life, and living this dream, beyond their wildest dream, skiing down a mountain in Norway. We couldn't fucking scooter car from the from one block to the other. You know what I mean? And here we were, and we left such a profound impact with people. The Irish always do it. I've done it in the Balkans. I go down to Mosquito, Montenegro, Slovenia, Serbia. All recently, the last couple of years, I went skiing down there. It was just for a couple of days, but I've done it anyway. I have fantastic friends in Croatia, Slovenia, Bosnia, you know, and Montenegro is where it is my go-to place. And I have really, really good friends there. And they, when I go there, they look after me. And I'm hoping to go now in the next few weeks to get a bit of work done in here at the Gaffin. And then I've got vaccines and go down. I'm going to go to the Adriatic, the part of Albania, to the Adriatic coast there. It's an incredible place. Incredible. And I've had so much, like that, you know what? I could be sitting with you for the next 5-6 days and I remember this and I remember that. Okay, but the whole experience for me has been incredible. When it was been, it was, I have sort of developed into this human being I never thought possible, right? And I never thought I could accomplish what I did, right? It's basic enough for some people, but for me to do what I've done and being provided with the opportunities, it wasn't just handed to me. I had to work extremely hard to do that. Not to go off and use when it was painful, when it was lonely and when it was hurt or resentful or someone decides that they don't want to be with you anymore, and that getting in the core, you got to your core. I remember my ex saying, I don't love you anymore. You know what I mean? And I had to swallow that without a drink or a drug or a nicotine or young, and I'm going, wow. And I'm like screaming and just screaming to the skies, to the heavens, you know? And because I couldn't grasp that level of that intensity, that emotional intensity, that I didn't have that emotional currency to deal with.
Yeah.
Again, I hadn't been taught and nurtured in that. I had drank my way through stuff. If we got rejected, I'd drink my way, I'd use my way, I'd find another woman, or you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and I'd start the whole cycle again. The difference now is that I don't seek it now. I don't seek to be with another woman. My wife, I think she's gone through menopause anyway, and this perimenopausal thing is caused all sorts of havoc. And she just wanted to time out. she hasn't now. Like, but I'm not gripped in pity I gotta accept that's just the way the reality of my life is now. I have loads of friends, I have a nice little home that I can. I can just chill out and stuff like that.
What a life! What a fucking life!
Mm-hmm.
We could sit here talking for hours. With all that you told me, you know, returning back to that sense of soul, I see the journey. You return back to what your pure essence was, which is kindness, compassion, understanding. What it was an inner knowing that you did, but just society didn't allow that to come to fruition. What's the one thing you would like to leave people after listening to this interview?
And that there's, you know, if you think that you're beyond help or that you feel that you're hopeless and it's not going to work for you, that if you trust and if you're, you know, if you have these problems, especially with substance abuse, any substance abuse, there is help. And I found the help that I needed in one addict helping another, just like me and you or another human being who identify themselves as addicts. It's not, it's a derogatory word. It's just, that's a term that we use. And people say, don't get hung up on the word, like, you know what I mean? Don't get hung up, you know? People are telly addicts, they're field addicts, they're all sorts
social
of problems.
Media.
You know what I mean? It's the whole litany of things that you can home in on. And we have minds that will look for differences. And if you're looking for them, you will find them. I found a place where I found a tribe that I could identify with, people who I knew were from the same side of the street, and also people who were from middle class. They talked about that powerlessness and that pain, and why you were taking drugs was to alleviate some of that pain. was a pain relief and pain, a painkiller for the trauma that they experienced in their life. And why their addicts, they don't know, but the acceptance of I am what I am and try to find your way in the world. I don't get it right all the time. I find myself having to apologize. The beauty about the 10 step and the 12 step is that you know, promptly admit when you're wrong and be humble enough to say, you know what, I was wrong. And I could never admit that. I would never admit that. Unless it was caught bank the rights, you know what I mean? Unless it was on video or the few witnesses would say, no, I couldn't do it. Freud wouldn't allow me. I've seen that as a very weak thing to do and very vulnerable. It would leave myself very vulnerable. But really, it's a strength that you can show some sort of humility to say, you know, I'm human and I make mistakes and people might like certain things about me. But I know now that I'm more than just some of the aspects of me that I need work on. I need to walk on, and it's like a work in progress all the time. And I have a mind that will just hone in on them little, you know, defects, I suppose. But all the experiences that I've had and all the things I had to, you know, process without the use of drugs have instilled this resolve in me and this character building exercise that I've had. Brothers, only one of my brothers died last year. He almost ate himself to death.
Eddie?
No, ate himself. Sure,
would you
no, Paul, Eddie? Paul,
sorry.
Eddie, right?
He used to try in the Ivy.
He used to be in the Ivy sometimes.
Yeah.
Lived next door to it. Yeah, and yes, he was. And that crucified him as well. He couldn't accept that he weren't as good anymore. And he'd be roaring at the bed.
Yeah.
And he ate himself and took... you know, pain relief from the doctors, from prescription medication, gambling, food, and he just lost the will to die, and then he just put on so much weight, he died, he just didn't want to live anymore. And I don't want to get to that, because you can get to that state of mind where you just, you know what, it's not a war of no kids, you have kids, you're able to do this, you seem to be able to do what I'm not able to do. He was well able to do it, but he just got lost, and to give him the, I mean, sometimes it was too close for comfort for me to try to, you know, trying to give him advice. It probably wasn't always a good thing to do, you know, because he didn't feel he was able to do that, and he was beyond that. And I had, for some reason, had the formula to do what he couldn't do, and it was available to him. He just couldn't see past himself, like, you know, to get out of the way yourself, you know.
Wow.
He said, it's, you know, there's loads of stuff that I hadn't got time, but it's whatever's happened, it's in the post anyway.
Yeah.
And deal with it when it comes and enjoy what I have. Be it, I'm a bit sad now with that, you know, but also there's an opportunity for me for growth and development as a result.
It's crazy that you speak about serendipity. You know, I'm here, I'm delighted with this podcast, amazing. I have my own struggles, mental health struggles, and I'm in the process now of thinking, will I go back and start having a few drinks? Will I do this? I'm sitting here with you now, and the pain that you went through, and the stuff you're telling me. So I'm meant to be here, sitting here having this conversation. I'm going, oh, fuck that, don't go back. Over the weekend, I was contemplating drinking. I haven't drank in a year, but I wanted to start medicating and drinking again.
Yeah.
I said, now fuck
it's
that.
It's so attractive, isn't it?
Oh, it's
see the ice thing, the little thing strong down. I have to see it through, and I see you're sitting under the umbrellas. The umbrellas be going through the windows, you know what I mean? I would be getting abusive, and if someone says, fuck you, and I was just an idiot.
I just go more drink, then I go back on the drugs.
And that's it. And then the same people who used to walk away from you when you were drunk, you go back in. I remember going in to watch a match. You're having a point, so you wouldn't even sit with me when I was drinking. What are you on about? I had one, and I knew as soon as I had one, I was gone. I couldn't stop. You say in the NA Fellowship or the NAA or whatever, one is too many and a town is never enough.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And I went into these places where, go on, have a point. One point? It's not more than I see the outcome of it. I see what I see the carnage then.
Yeah,
see, I left it like a what's it called, a nuclear waste site, you might mean, you know what I mean? But I went about trying to change.
You're an unbelievable man, and I can't thank you enough. Tony, what a fucking interview. Thanks very much. I really appreciate change for sharing your story. I was emotionally impacted with that. Fucking phenomenal. Incredible human being.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Guys, thanks very much. That was an absolute belter. I absolutely loved it. I want to thank your brother Kieran for putting me on to Tony. It went beyond my expectations. I thought it'd be good. I didn't think it'd be that good. I didn't realise how much of an incredible human being he is. If anything impacts you on that show, whether it be the drink, the drugs, the mental health, that we talk about, reach out, reach for help, ask your community, tell a friend. It doesn't have to be a counsellor. As my pal in the hospital, Maria, Dr. Marie Frampton, says, a friend is cheaper than a psychiatrist, and she's a psychiatrist. But we can put you in contact with anyone that needs to, or anyone that can help you. Pieta House, Shannon's Hope Line, Mental Health Warriors, whoever it is, we can try to point you in that direction. So mind your little self. I want to give a shout out to Andy, Liberty's Media Hub, Noel Riley from Rooney Media Graphics, the girls from Shannon's Hope Line, doing amazing work in the Liberties around mental health and building grassroots strength for kids around mental health and suicide. The guys from Liberty Soup Run, from all the people that send in the love and kindness, all the support we're getting from Yuck the Flats. I truly believe the people in the flats are amazing. I just want to spread that. Thanks to my man Andy. And you guys, so I mean this from the bottom of your heart. Mind your little self in service of your family, your community, and your country. It's really important, isn't it? And what we spoke with Tony and my own story is that inner child, that little kid that didn't get the love, the kindness, the passion, the attachment. Not anyone's fault or blame, just what it was. That's just the way they were growing up. If you can recognize that, that's how we start minding our little self and we break this generational blame.
And some people would consider me a little bollocks as well. But I hear you, and you know what, you shout out to a lot of things, a lot of people who without that help would impact, have a negative impact on people. And I know people who are in dire need of help, and you mentioned lots of people, and I know some people involved in them, in them agencies, and they do remarkable work and incredible work and giving of themselves without looking for anything. I think that's a very honourable thing.
Yeah, I do amazing. And I truly believe that the greatest worldwide pandemic, epidemic, is childhood trauma. Because anybody from my own pain, other people's pain, a lot of it comes from that child. And no blame the parents, because we can't blame the parents, we're blaming the grandparents, super grandparents, next. But blame doesn't do. Acceptance is the way, as you said there. It's about acceptance. So look, thanks very much. That was a powerful, powerful interview. We fucking loved it. Take care. Yo, the plot.